Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're tackling something, well, something pretty fascinating and definitely contentious. It's this surprising, very visible trend. Some evangelical Christians turning quite sharply against the modern nation of Israel.
Yeah, it's a noticeable shift. And we're diving deep into one specific analysis today. An analysis that argues this backlash isn't just flawed, it's actually profoundly hypocritical.
Hypocritical, how so?
Because, the argument goes, it's rooted in a deep misunderstanding of both history and prophecy.
Okay, so our mission here is to unpack this really dense, multi-layered narrative. It apparently spans, what, 3,000 years?
Yeah.
From an ancient kingdom split through Ezekiel's visions right up to 1960s geopolitics.
That's the scope, yeah. The goal is for you, the listener, to get a thorough grasp of this specific framework. It's a critique that really forces Western Christendom to look hard at its own compromises before, you know, casting judgment.
And the source material connects ancient biblical prophecy to current politics by focusing on something it calls a long-forgotten family feud.
Exactly. A feud right at the heart, it claims, of the modern Christian-Jewish divide.
Wow. Okay. And the current situation, this contradiction, it's hard to miss, right? Our source points out how many Christians seem to be judging national Israel using really strong language.
Very strong. Things like alleging genocide or calling them the synagogue of Satan, even claiming they're puppet masters behind a new world order or financial conspiracies.
Which is just a complete reversal from the Christian Zionism we saw so much of in previous decades.
A total flip. But here's where the source pushes back hard. It argues that those making these big judgments are, well, equally compromised, morally, politically.
So they're speaking from a kind of false superiority.
That's the core argument, that we in Western Christendom are often blind to our own spiritual identity. The source mentions being fellow citizens with the saints in the Commonwealth of Israel.
Let's pause right there. When the source cites Ephesians 2, saying we're fellow citizens, what's the real implication there for someone listening? What does that actually mean?
Well, what the source is saying is crucial, I think. It means Western Christians shouldn't see themselves as, like, objective outsiders judging Israel from a distance. Theologically, according to this view, they're woven into the very same historical and prophetic story as the Jewish house.
So our fates are intertwined in a way.
That's the idea. The fate of one is tied to the other. We're not just external referees.
Got it. And the source doesn't just talk about general moral blindness, right? It gets specific, arguing Western Christendom is involved in what it calls the snake pit. That sounds pretty intense.
It is intense language. The source suggests entanglement, even in, you know, traditional evangelical circles, with powerful, sometimes hidden forces. It mentions things ranging from certain elements within the Vatican and Jesuits to elite oligarchs, even suggesting links to darker realms referenced by groups like the Luciferian Illuminati.
Okay, hold on. Is this suggesting literal organizational ties, or is it more symbolic?
It seems more about being compromised by association. The point isn't necessarily a direct conspiracy chart, but that we're just as tangled up with wicked people and rebellious spiritual forces. Therefore, the source says, we have absolutely no ground for a holier-than-thou judgment against Israel.
That's a really strong claim. Very controversial. Why use that kind of language, though? Why snake pit?
I think because it wants to redefine the core conflict. The key definition here, for the source, is that anti-Semitism isn't just hating Jewish people.
Yeah.
At its root, it's defined as being anti-throne of David and having an anti-Christ spirit.
Anti-throne of David, meaning?
Meaning, if you attack the covenant people who hold the promise tied to the Messiah's return, which is linked to the throne of David, you're actually attacking the core promise of salvation itself. So the judgment being thrown around by some Christians today might be coming from a place that's spiritually off base, regardless of current political disagreements.
Okay, that's a heavy framework. Let's unpack the core argument about restoration then. The source argues that a lot of this modern Christian judgment stems from impatience, right? Because Israel's spiritual restoration is still a work in progress.
Exactly. It definitely wasn't, you know, all wrapped up and finalized in 1948.
And this is where Ezekiel's vision comes in, the Valley of Dry Bones.
Precisely. Ezekiel 37 provides the framework according to this analysis. The restoration isn't just one event. It's portrayed as a sequential spiritual drama happening in stages. The dry bones coming together, getting sinews and skin. That's the political and physical regathering.
Okay, so the creation of the State of Israel in 1948, that was just the sinews and skin stage, not the final act.
That's how the source interprets it, yes.
Yeah.
the political and physical framework being put back together. But the ultimate stage, the full spiritual awakening that's described as the breath of life, the Holy Spirit truly awakening the nation.
And that part, the spiritual culmination, happens much later, near the end of the age.
That's the timeline presented, yeah.
So if we accept that framework, it really dictates our posture towards modern Israel, doesn't it? If these early steps are just the fleshly political activities on the bones, as this source puts it.
Then the advice is to withhold judgment. These early movements might not always look pretty, but we need patience until God finishes the work.
Right. And this political rattling, as the source calls it, started way before 1948.
Oh, yeah. Long before. You had secular forces like Theodor Herzl in 1896 calling for a secular state in their Judenstadt.
Huh.
But at the same time, you had British and American evangelicals in the 19th century who were convinced prophetically that a return to the land had to happen.
And then World War I becomes this sort of violent catalyst. The source mentions the rattling sound of machine guns in 1917, and specifically the Australian Light Horse Charge at Beersheba, October 31st.
It's an amazing detail, isn't it? The source connects this huge military gamble directly to a prophetic timeline. That cavalry charge, it was incredibly risky from a military standpoint, but it was a stunning success. It broke the Ottoman front, opened the way to Jerusalem.
And the source sees that as God literally opening a geopolitical door.
That's the interpretation.
Huh?
And the political result followed almost instantly.
2 days later, November 2nd, 1917, the Balfour Declaration. Giving that sort of official door of hope for a Jewish homeland?
Yeah, and many evangelicals at the time saw that as pointing towards a biblical Zion, not just, you know, politics as usual.
Okay, fast forward past World War II, the Holocaust.
Yeah.
The return gathers pace. 1948. The sinews and skin come fully together. Groups like the Haganah, the Irgun, forming the military structure, establishing sovereignty.
Right, the State of Israel is declared. And what's really interesting is the name they chose. President Truman, who supported the state, was apparently quite surprised they picked Israel.
Why surprised?
Because Israel implies all 12 tribes, the whole historic nation. He might have expected Judah, referring just to the southern kingdom that historically returned from exile.
Ah, that choice of name is actually a perfect lead-in. It brings us right to that theological core you mentioned, the long-forgotten, festering family feud that the source claims is still causing friction today.
Yes, this is really central to the analysis. It argues that the foundation for today's tension, where some Christians oppose Israel, goes back 3,000 years, right back to the split of the kingdom after King Solomon died, around 932 BC.
Okay, this is the breach of Jeroboam you talked about. How does a tax dispute from antiquity turn into a theological rift that, according to this source, lasts millennia?
Well, the story goes like this. Solomon dies, his son Rehoboam takes over. The people, led by Jeroboam, come asking for relief from Solomon's heavy taxes and forced labor, you know, all the building projects. Rehoboam basically had two choices. Listen to the older, wiser advisors and ease up, or listen to his young buddies.
And he chose arrogance, didn't he?
He did. Told them he'd make things even heavier. The result was catastrophic.
Yeah.
The great divorce of Israel. The 10 northern tribes just walked out. They rejected the house of David completely, cursed the royal line.
So boom. Two separate kingdoms, the southern kingdom, Judah, kept the lineage, the scepter, leading eventually to the Messiah. And they did eventually return to the land after the Babylonian exile, right? Under leaders like Zerubbabel, Ezra, Nehemiah.
Correct. That's the house of Judah. But the northern kingdom, those 10 tribes, they fell hard into idolatry almost immediately. God eventually prophetically divorced them. Hosea calls them not my people. Then, 722 BC, the Assyrians conquered them, took them captive.
And they basically vanished from history as a distinct sovereign group, the Lost Tribes.
Pretty much. They never returned in significant sovereign numbers. They were scattered and assimilated.
Okay, so connecting those ancient dots to now, who does the source identify as the modern inheritors of those two houses?
Right. So today, the Jewish house obviously represents Judah, holding that royal scepter promise. But the Lost Ten Tribes, the ones exiled and scattered, they are often identified in this framework with Western Christendom, prophetically referred to as Ephraim.
Ephraim. Okay, so this ancient split explains the ongoing mutual vexation and jealousy.
That's the argument. It's a family feud that never really got resolved. The source points to Isaiah 11.13, which prophesies a time when Ephraim shall not envy Judah, and Judah shall not vex Ephraim, implying they currently do.
So the current Christian criticism of Israel isn't just modern politics. It's potentially an echo of that ancient family fight.
It frames it that way, yes. still fighting over legitimacy, over who's right, who gets to judge whom.
Okay, so given this long, really messy history, what does it mean for Christians pointing fingers today? The source is blunt, saying both houses, Judah, Jewish, and Ephraim, Christian, are currently in a bit of a mess.
Yeah, totally entangled. The source argues both are pretty... both are involved in worldly, violent, treacherous dealings on the global stage.
Like state intelligence agencies, Mossad, CIA, doing ungodly things.
That's mentioned, yes. Targeted assassinations, covert operations. The argument is both sides have dirty hands in the shadows of international politics. They're mirroring each other.
So the point isn't that Israel is blameless, but that Western Christendom isn't some innocent bystander either.
Exactly. The analysis aims to show that the West is just as stained by collusion and conspiracy, especially during Israel's early, more fleshly restoration phase.
And the dramatic piece of evidence the source uses for this shared compromise is the USS Liberty incident in 1967. That sounds explosive.
It is. It happened during the Six-Day War. The context was fear, shared by the U.S. and Israel, that Russia might jump in to help Egypt. Now, the source details what it calls an astonishing tacit agreement between the U.S. and Israel.
An agreement to do what?
For Israeli forces' planes and torpedo boats to attack and sink the USS Liberty, a clearly marked American spy ship in international waters.
Wait, attack their allies' ship? Sink it. Why on earth?
The plan, according to this source, was a false flag operation. They'd blame the attack on Egypt. This would then give the U.S. the pretext for massive retaliation, maybe even using nuclear threats against Russia to scare them off from entering the war.
That's quite a charge. Did the plan work?
No. Despite multiple attack runs, Mirage fighters, napalm, torpedoes the ship, miraculously, some say, did not sink. It was terribly damaged, many casualties, but the false flag failed. President Johnson was reportedly furious it wasn't sunk.
Wow. So this incident is presented as proof positive that Western powers, represented by the U.S. government here, are deeply involved in the same kind of collusion and conspiracies they might accuse others of.
Precisely. It makes Christian judgment towards Israel look incredibly hypocritical in this light. The pot calling the kettle black, essentially.
Both sides acting like Jacob the trickster, as the source puts it.
Yeah, still kind of sneaky, political, wrestling with God, you might say. Yeah. Neither side operating in full spiritual maturity yet. Both still a work in progress.
Okay, so let's recap. We've traced this 3,000-year family feud, looked at the idea of a sequential restoration based on Ezekiel, and seen the argument that both houses are currently compromised politically and carnally.
Right. And it's crucial to remember the ultimate destiny described in the source. It's very clear that the final victory won't come through the current flawed political or military means, not through political Zionism alone, whether Jewish-led or backed by crusading Christian Zionism.
Because that kind of power will ultimately fail.
That's what the source argues, citing Daniel 12, that the power and politics of the holy people will eventually be completely shattered just before the end.
So the only way forward then is divine intervention.
Absolutely. The victory comes only by the Spirit of God. That's what ushers in the great end time revival spoken of in Joel chapter 2. And that spiritual event is what finally ends the blood feud, dissolves this dispensational divide,
and brings all Israel together. Judah and Ephraim Christendom.
Yes, standing unified as the royal priesthood and holy nation. That's the completion of the restoration promise in Ezekiel 37, according to this interpretation.
So the ultimate message seems to be, distance ourselves from hatred, even when critiquing actions.
Yes, and recognize that true reconciliation isn't political. It's spiritual, maybe even forged through shared experience.
Shared experience, how?
Well, the source makes a provocative suggestion that in times to come, Jews and Christians might actually face persecution together. Forced into a shared hardship, these camp meetings, as the source calls them, could be what finally straightens out the old family feud and forces reconciliation based on shared faith, not politics.
That's definitely a thought to leave people with. You might ask yourself, if that kind of unity requires shared suffering down the line, what common ground could you possibly build now with those you disagree with before things potentially get tougher?